This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the publishing industry. I'm David Wilk, your host, and today I'm talking to John Oakes, who is one of the co-founders of a new publishing company called OR Books. Although I asked John initially, is it O-R or OR, or is it Oakes Robinson? And maybe this gives you a chance to talk a little bit about...
And I rolled my eyes because, to tell you the truth, it's really whatever you want to call it.
But OR Books.
Well, Colin and I say OR Books.
Okay. And the website is orbooks.com.
Yes, sir.
So, I know you've been in publishing for quite a long time. So has Colin. Maybe you could talk a little bit about your backgrounds, how you got here, all of that stuff.
Sure. So, I started out in publishing with Barney Ross. It's Grove Press. And Barney, I was actually a reporter down in New Orleans. And I got to know Barney through some... I just got to know him, and he invited me to come up to New York and be an editor, and that's how I found myself on the slippery slope of publishing.
So this was in what year?
I'm embarrassed to tell you, David. You weren't even born then.
Yeah.
It was 1985, I think it was.
Okay.
And... It was really the close of, Grove was in its, the old Grove, the Grove you know today, Grove Atlantic under Morgan Entrekin, who's a very talented publisher, that is a very different company from the Grove Press that I knew,
right.
Which really came straight out of the beat and avant-garde tradition of the post-war era. It really was the sort of last presence of that in America, and it was a great thing. You know, we were publishing UNESCO. I did a UNESCO book while I was there, and, you know, it was wonderful. We'd have champagne every Friday afternoon. It was very different.
So how long were you there?
It was very short. It was like 2 years, 2.5 years, and then the Gettys had bought Grove Press, and that's what enabled Barney to hire me. I mean, I didn't take $1 billion, but it was, you know, he was expanding again. And but then the Gettys found Barney to be an unmanageable employee, which he, I think, proudly was. And they fired him, and it was just a bad ending to, in what is, in my opinion, he's still creating, and he's still a dynamic person, but that stage of his career, I mean, it put an end to that, and I think he's one of the most significant cultural figures in post-war America, you know.
Influenced a lot of publishers.
Yes, and
today,
beyond publishing, he influenced the culture in
yeah.
all sorts of ways in terms of how we view sex and just the open discussion of things that were never talked about. The kind of books that he published openly were only sold in, like, you know, curtain bookstores off of Times Square. Anyway, after Grove, I went to Henry Holt briefly under Richard Siever. And while I was there, I met a guy who seemed to share my views on art and politics, and I thought he and I could just sort of start up a little publishing company on the side, wouldn't interfere with Holt. And the guy was Dan Simon, and we started this thing, Four Walls, Eight Windows. That was like in 1988, about. And unfortunately, or fortunately, Four Walls started to get a little prominent, though it really, I did all my work at Holt, but Holt didn't like the fact that I was doing this thing on the side, so I got fired. And then Four Walls started growing, and we had quite a run. We published Abby Hoffman and Andrea Dworkin and R. Crumb and Harvey Pekar and Jerome Charon, and really some wonderful writers. We brought back some books, did some Nelson Algren, Sherwood Anderson, the Hart Crane letters, and really had a it was quite a run. And so Dan and I worked together for 7 years, and then we split up, and I continued with Four Walls, and I ran it for another 10 years, and then I sold it to Avalon. I bet you're sorry you asked me about my career in publishing.
No, this is important. It's good. Anyway, it's background.
Well, I sold it to Avalon, and then Avalon, I just, after 2 years working at Avalon, I just had to leave. And so I helped James Atlas start up his Atlas & Co. And I'm afraid I left there, too, on my own steam. I didn't think the direction that was going was something I wanted to do. But what's interesting, what could be interesting to a student of, or an observer of publishing in this, is that, you know, I've had quite a view of different types of independent presses. You know, I did my own small press, barely, you know, just fighting tooth and nail, Four Walls. Then at Avalon, it was another type of independent press where you basically, you published as many books as you could, as fast as you could. You know, it was the principle, you throw everything at the wall and hope something sticks. And in the course of that, we did some great books, but overall, the quality was not what one would hope for. And then at Atlas, you had tremendous resources, but you were confined to doing very few books, sort of in a very precious atmosphere, and really fine books, but you still couldn't get the kind of audience and the impact that I wanted to get. I mean, I had the privilege of working with tremendous, you know, people like Edmund White and Richard Reeves and Louis Begley. You know, it was really a very, so it was a different aspects of the independent press.
And so do you think that, you know, in the sense of the development of the publishing business or the evolution of the publishing business during this period of time, because things have changed, you know, and they've gone through various gyrations, which we probably don't need to document here.
Yeah.
But, you know, through all that time, you were also navigating not just your own, the work you were trying to publish,
yeah,
but also this kind of changing world.
Well, that's right. That's absolutely true. And what's interesting is that at the beginning, you know, Barney said to me, because the personal computer had only been out a few years, really, he said, you know, these computers are going to be the salvation of publishing. And it's true, typesetting costs have dropped, you know, over what I remember, you know, 20 years ago, paying $8 a page was standard. But, and so that went down, and cover design costs have gone down. But the problem is that concurrently, the number of titles has skyrocketed, and it's so much more difficult than it ever was to make yourself heard in this sort of sea of mush. And I'm one of those who, I do not believe that if a work of quality will necessarily rise to the top. And
but has that been true ever?
I remember, actually, somewhere you could probably dig it up, I remember specifically Alberto Vitali, which is a name for the past. He used to be, I guess, CEO of Random House, saying that, exactly that, that yes, he was convinced that a quality book would always, you know, make its way, become known, and, you know, that it didn't matter, didn't have anything to do with the company or anything like that.
And yeah, see, I've never really believed that myself.
Well, we're in agreement then. but what I saw over these various incarnations of independent presses, what I saw with different setups was that the system of distribution and production and sales, as you and I have been familiar with it, it's not only inefficient, it's insane. It doesn't work. It doesn't work for the stores, who end up having all this inventory on their shelves that they can't move. It doesn't work for authors. It certainly doesn't work for publishers. And, you know, I'm not sure it even works for consumers. But hopefully with the advent of new technologies, actually something really good can come out of this that won't involve the death of the independent stores, which, as you know, I don't really deal with stores anymore, but I would hate to see that culture die.
Well, and of course, I mean, that's a separate track, which I think we can touch on, but let's follow the thread here is...
Okay.
You've now, you and Colin, yeah. Robinson, who
so,
has...
So I, right, he, so Colin, meantime, so Colin was a publisher of Verso Books.
A pretty radical political publisher from England that I think at one time was owned by the Coal Miners Union.
I think that may be true.
I think it was.
And Colin himself is a proud Scots-Liverpool mix. And but he came over here to he ran Verso and then ran was publisher of the New Press, and years ago he and I had talked about doing some kind about maybe 5-6 years ago doing some kind of a lefty venture, and we thought this was obviously before President Obama, and we thought we could do a sort of left wing version of Regnery Gateway, and I think we were right. The people we approached to do this for various reasons didn't want to go along with us, and but we obviously stayed in touch. And then he was working at Simon & Schuster, and they, I think I can say they kicked him out. He's written a very funny article about that experience for the London Review of Books, which... talks about this corporate culture and, you know, going from one day to the next. You know, one day you're in, and then the next day you're called into someone's office, and boom, you're out. And there's a security guard there to walk you back to your office to make sure you don't pocket any, you know, paper clips or something. And that's just the way it works.
So... by virtue of his being fired,
so he was out, and I had quit, and I was sort of staring at the ceiling, and that's not quite true, but you know, and he, I think, was very much a motivator for this concept, and I was skeptical at first. I felt that I think one can almost say, stated as a fact. That the current system, it's not just a matter of criticizing it. It is a broken. If the boat isn't sinking, it's just a question of time. It is falling apart. It's guesswork on top of guesswork. It's inefficiency on top of inefficiency. It's based on untruths and on selling that has very little relation to fact. And I can walk through that unless you feel your listeners have heard that in too many incarnations already. But we talked about doing this sort of web-based venture that would sell directly to consumers, would not sell on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or to wholesalers, and would not sell to independent stores either.
Right, so basically, yep. Orbooks, the principle is you sell direct to consumer only.
Right.
It's all web based, and I believe you said you'll sell people either print books or ebooks.
Yeah.
So now are you publishing in every ebook format?
As many of them? Yeah, we have no, we call ourselves platform agnostic, and we're certainly going to, we're trying to do that. If we now offer PDF and EPUB and .mobi, which is...
Do you go directly to Amazon for Kindle?
No, we do nothing with Kindle. .mobi can
is
be
a
read
Kindle,
on Kindle.
It's a Kindle...
Yeah.
It's
Kindle friendly.
Right, because Kindle actually came from Mobi. That's right, because they bought Mobi Fusion. But you don't sell to Amazon.
No.
So the platforms would include Sony... But not Nook? You don't sell to Barnes & Noble?
Well, we actually, I mean, we sell electronically at least one book to Barnes & Noble. But our general principle, and one of the fun things about OR books, as it's happened, is our flexibility. I mean, so if you're cruel, you could say our inconsistency. But almost without exception, we do not sell to stores, period. Right. Now, if
so
a store...
pure direct.
And there's several reasons for this. And if a store really, like we have an author appearance or something, for example, Eileen Miles is a tremendous performer, and just she's fantastic, and that's a lot of what she's about. And so we have to do, you have to do events with her, so in those cases, we will make some exceptions to work directly with stores,
right.
But generally, we don't. And then the motto is we sell to consumers, we do a lot of marketing for the book, ads, promotional film, and then we hope we can license it to
right.
a traditional publisher.
Right, so if the book becomes successful in your direct-to-consumer model,
right.
and there are a lot of people who, I think there are people in the book business, I think it's safe to say, who have observed the way things are going, not just you
mm-hmm.
or me, and who have said similarly that, you know, if the publishers, it's very difficult right now for a publisher to make a book successful through the traditional channels, because the system doesn't work. So if you have the right kind of product, the thinking is you would go directly to consumer. I mean, it's actually an old idea. You know, Rodale was a direct-to-consumer business. There have been many other direct-to-consumer businesses.
Way before Rodale, you know, Mark Twain, his books
right.
were sold, and I'm sure other authors too, but I know Twain's books were sold door-to-door by salespeople
yes.
on a subscription basis.
That's right.
So
that was the late 19th century model, was publishers sold to readers. They might even have a store downstairs, you know, but they
sure.
it was a very different model.
Like Melville House does in Brooklyn, you know, they have
right.
their store right there.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so, traditionally, people who have thought about the direct-to-consumer model for publishers have said, well, you need to be in a niche that's a recognizable, coherent niche, maybe a brand idea, so that, in other words, like Rodale is about health.
Yeah.
And wellness. And you could imagine a publisher doing weaving books who knows the weaving business really well, and they know exactly how to talk to weavers. But what you're trying to do is different. You're not saying, you know, we're not picking a craft. You're not picking a niche
that's right.
recognizable in that sort of hands-on way. You know, it's not car books. It's not train books. It's not airplane books. You're publishing literature. Books about ideas, books that are about current ideas, and you're talking to consumers. So how do you do that?
Well, you first of all, I want to thank you for that description, because I consider that high praise, what you said about us. And in many ways, that's right. And in fact, we have more to do with sort of the model of an early Grove Press, perhaps without Barney's fascination with erotica.
Right.
I mean, I have nothing against it. It's
right.
just not one
that's
of my
just
passions.
Not what you're doing.
You know,
but yeah, that's
I can show you my dirty magazines later, David, when we turn off the microphone. But
no one will be able to see them. Though.
Oh, but that's right. We have the mix of we're interested in certain types of literature and things that push the cultural envelope and
social
change. And we're absolutely committed to social change, and Colin in particular has a very distinguished history in this area. But you know, I also published a bunch of a good number of titles. I reissued Tom Hayden's Port Huron Statement when I was at Nation Books, and as I say, Abby Hoffman, and we've done been committed to social change. But so how do we do it? Well, we see, I think it's fair to say that while there are certain currents in our program, each book is like an individual. It's like a person, and each book needs to have an individually crafted marketing and publicity program. And you can't just do a generic publicity campaign. It has to be specifically tailored to the book and the author.
And so do you work with the author?
Absolutely.
On the marketing?
Absolutely. It has to be a cooperative enterprise. Now, I don't think this is very important point. We're not one of those publishers who, as is often the case, and authors will tell you, and people who aren't familiar with this won't believe it, but it's absolutely true that publishers, once you've signed up with a Midtown publisher, they'll turn to the author and say, so now, how are we going to market this book? What are you going to do for us, right? And the authors, you know, I mean, that to me is the publisher's job is to market and to edit and to design and to get the book out to the consumer with the author's help and wise input. But that is our responsibility. So, for example, on this book, In Deep Water, which is a book we're doing with the NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council, about Deepwater Horizon and the whole oil mess that we're in. Obviously, we want NRDC's input and guidance, but we're not going to rely on that totally. You know, doing a film that we're putting together and you know, we're placing ads on Grist magazine.
You mean like a documentary film? Or
we do short
promotion. Or like a trailer kind
of
trailer
thing. Yeah, for each book, we do a professionally produced short film.
Right, and then distribute that online. Maybe it goes to YouTube and
absolutely
all the other video posting sites.
Yeah, for Eileen Miles, for example, there's this tremendous video of her both reading and talking a bit about her book. We did a really nice one also with Gordon Lish, and for Midnight on the Mavi Marmara, we had one of the people was actually on the boat. A film from that, you know, from the flotilla that was attacked by Israel.
Yeah.
So that's a very important part of
so, there is some, continuity in your publishing program, obviously. So, you know, although it's not clear that a person who bought an Eileen Miles book would necessarily buy, let's say, a Bill McKibben book.
I agree with you 100%.
But it's important for you to have... A database of names, I presume.
Yeah. It probably would be easier if we were just publishing, say, edgy fiction or environmental books or books about the Middle East. But frankly, to me, it's a hell of a lot less interesting. It's not a very exciting way to live one's life.
Right. And you have the publisher's impulse, I think, which is, you know, there is a certain element of, you know, no matter what, publishing is about the enthusiasm for the book, and it's a kind of reflection of your own kind of cultural psyche. And that, I always have thought of publishing in that way as almost like writing. That you write about the things that interest you. You publish.
Or that you're curious about.
Right.
Yeah.
And maybe it's a book that you love because it challenges your thinking or it makes you, you know, feel a certain way. So I think the impulse there, you know, to the kind of, I think that is the continuity among a kind of enthusiasm for publishing that's looked at as entrepreneurial or creative, and that's what you're doing.
Very nice of you to say. But I, you know, as you were saying that, I was thinking, you know, it's the same relationship, you know, between, Eileen Miles and, this book we did on the Gaza invasion, This Time We Went Too Far by Norman Finkelstein, as you have between, you know, early Grove titles like Frantz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth and Eugene Ionesco or Genet. I mean, somebody looking at that at the time might have scratched their head. But, you know, there is a consistency in outlook. And we're not dogmatic, but we are, I think, adventurous.
So do you have a sense of scope? I mean, obviously you probably didn't sit down and say, well, we're going to do 8 books a year, but...
Actually, we did sit down and say, and Colin and I sparred about this. Colin very intelligently said we should do, you know, no more than 1 book a month, and I, coming out of this school of, you know, dozens of books a month. I said, no, we got to do more. So we're somewhere in between. We're probably right now doing 1.5, maybe.
Which is a lot of books.
Two, for us, it's a lot of books. Yeah, right
so
now I'm having a nervous breakdown.
It's basically you and Colin and how many other people?
We have two extremely competent people work with us and one intern. And we have an office, which we rent down in Desprosa Street, very small office. As big as the room we're sitting in right now.
Given that you're selling direct, does that mean you have to stock books in your office?
No. Well, we have some books in the office, but we do not ship out of there. We have a good relationship with a printer who ships straight out of... And our goal is to have no warehousing. Right. I have to be honest with you. In fact, because we're still figuring this out. We're still refining the science. But we have some books backed up. But generally, you know, our inventory is nothing like what it would be with a traditional publisher.
Is it a digital printing system?
It depends, because we try to do offset printing.
Because of the savings in cost.
Yes, the unit price is much less. But we will go to...
So you can go back and forth, too.
Yeah.
I mean, so theoretically, then, you'll print a certain number of books.
Yes.
And sell down that inventory. Yeah. And then in that sense, you're going to be like a traditional publisher. You have to manage your inventory against demand and try to scale the...
What I'd really like to do is get to the point where we have no inventory. And you can, you know, as the orders pile up, then you send them out in a burst.
Right.
But...
digital printing is still too costly per unit. It's not impossible, but it does make it easier to be profitable if you can print a couple of thousand books.
Absolutely. But, you know, we have a few things in our favor which have erased my skepticism about this model as I've experienced it. And number one is no returns, zero returns. We do not accept returns.
Right, changes everything.
That is an amazing thing. And then number two is the vast majority of our sales are at 90 or 100% of the price.
Right. Well, the price is the real price.
The price is
In other words, there's no discounting going on.
Yeah.
The price you set is the price that you feel that you can make money on and that's comfortable for the consumer.
Yeah.
So what are your most your books sell for? What's the retail price?
Well, you know, we do paper, but we've experimented. We have one hardcover, but I think paperback is really what we're going to be doing.
Yeah.
And they retail for around $16.
And when you sell e-books, you sell a PDF, let's say.
Yeah, I think it's $9 or $10.
Right.
And now I think it's worth saying that, and by the way, Colin and I may have slightly different views on this, but we do agree on this, that when we release a book, we release the e-book and the print book at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, it's astounding to me that, I mean, things are happening so quickly, but still, already last Christmas, Amazon reported... was the first day, Christmas Day, I think, the first time they ever sold more e-books than hardcovers,
right?
That is a historic milestone. Like 2 or 3 weeks after that event, two of the five biggest publishers, Hachette and Simon & Schuster, announced that they were going to delay the release of their e-books. I think it was 3 months after the release of their hardcovers, because they didn't want to cannibalize their hardcover sales. To me, you know, I mean, I just, you know, here you have people who want to buy the book, but they don't want the hardcover. They don't want to spend $35 for the hardcover. And, you know, this is $27. I'm looking at a Wolf Hall, you know, this perfectly... a great book, you know, 540 pages or something. They don't want, apart from the money, they don't want this bulky thing. They want an e-book. They may not even want to keep the book. They just want to read it. But if you sort of force them into your way of thinking, I mean, Christ, it seems like, I don't know if I'm allowed to say that on
of course
a,
you are.
It just gets me apoplectic. To me, if somebody wants to buy the book, it's my duty as publisher within, you know, reason to make it available to them and to make it as convenient and as hassle-free as possible.
Well, but that's what you are doing, and what you have the opportunity to do is create clean sheet of paper publishing. In other words, you can say, okay, here are the here's the business as I see it today, and I'm going to try to publish as best I can in that environment.
Yeah.
Someone who has an existing business with a lot of overhead already in place may not be feel that they can do that. They have embedded costs that they can't justify.
I mean, they try and amortize. You know, they say, well, you know, the e-book's so expensive. You know, it's like they're operating in a different universe. The e-book costs fractions of pennies, and they say, well, you have to, you know, spread the cost for the title. But it's not true. The e-book, you already have the typesetting. It costs, what, maybe $500 to format it for EPUB. I mean, to do nice, e-friendly design. And then it costs very little. And by the way, I do not think it's a small thing. It's also a hell of a lot better for the environment instead of, you know, all these trucks sending stuff from your printer to the wholesaler, from the wholesaler to the bookstore, and the store back to the wholesaler.
We need an analysis. I felt this way for a long time. That a complete end-to-end carbon and energy analysis of a book industry would be really helpful.
Well,
because there are, you know, there are people who will argue that, you know, the iPad, which I have, or the Kindle, you know, these are devices which they require silicon and to make them requires energy, and there are lots of very bad chemicals in them, and then to operate them requires energy, of course, too. Now, I'm not, I actually believe kind of almost instinctively that the iPad or iPhone or Kindle or whatever device it is has a lower impact than printing books. Because the poison of ink is actually quite large, and the amount of transportation. I counted in the average book, there are 6 transportation touches embedded in there. I mean, that's from the point where the tree is cut down and hauled to a mill, and then turned into paper and hauled to another mill, and then turned, sent to the printer, and then the printer has to ship it to a warehouse, and the warehouse has to ship it to another warehouse. So there's a lot of freight
Plus, in addition to that, the actual manufacturing of the paper, which almost always involves dioxin, which is a charming chemical. And, you know, it's very interesting, this point, because here you have a profession that's, you know, not uniformly, but it's basically staffed by people who like to think, right? You like to read, you like to think about ideas. And it is, I think, hugely unfriendly to the environment. And, you know, it has to be dragged kicking and screaming into using recycled paper because it adds a penny or two, but fractional amount to the cost of these books. And, you know, these e-books, I think there's no question that they're many, many times better than I mean, they don't take up the space, the warehousing. I mean, when you add up the various costs involved, I just think it would be... And obviously, the longer you use your iPad, the better...
Right, or the more efficient. Right, the more books you read on it, in fact, the more theoretical savings there are. So, well, so here you have Orbooks as a kind of, let's say, a different way of publishing... set up from the beginning. And how long do you think, you know, how many years do you think you have to do it to kind of, one, debug it, learn how it will be different? Because, you know, there are things that you'll imagine one way and maybe they'll turn out to be a different way. You know, and how long before you'll know whether it's successful or not?
Well, I would say to you that we were very lucky with our first book, which at least, to my mind, proved... it could be successful. First book, you know, was this Going Rouge, which it's been described as a parody of Sarah Palin's autobiography, but in fact, it's a very substantial book. I mean, the title and the cover is a parody and makes a lot of fun of her, but the insides are very, you know, careful and thoughtful and at times funny critique of her. But we had a huge success with that, and it was a national bestseller, 50,000 copies. And I think so that's demonstrated that this model does work. But I think the real people we have to convert, I don't think it's consumers, it's certainly not authors, even major agents have come around. You know, we've done deals with Trident Media, with Watkins Loomis, with, Brockman, you know, not all, but a lot of big names. The people we still have to convert are these very timorous publishers who are saying, well, you know, how are we going to release this when you've already put it out there?
Oh, I see. You mean the people that, in your model,
yeah.
the other second leg,
right.
Let's say,
right.
Is that you want to be able to sell it to the people who are still in the traditional
right.
business,
exactly.
who have to put up with, paper and returns.
They're the people who face these editorial boards and who are going to ask, well,
right.
you know.
But so you're going to give them a book that's successful.
Yeah.
You're proving the case for the book.
Excuse me. Well, successful, yeah, and has gotten write-ups and has a little marketing campaign behind it and is edited and is nicely designed and professional, you know, covers. We use some of the same cover designers Midtown publishers use, so there's no change about them. And the way we see it is the same we used to be. In many ways, we're a throwback, you know, because we see it in a way as though we were a hardcover publisher. There used to be hardcover publishers who would just do hardcovers, and then they'd license the paperback rights to the paperback houses. And that's what we see ourselves as
right,
doing.
Right, in a sense, that's your model, is to be the... You're the first generator of the book.
Right.
And then for all other purposes,
yeah.
you would license it to another publisher to do whatever they do.
Right.
So, but you're saying that publishers that you are thinking of selling the books to or licensing the books to for print editions are less readily, they're less willing to take these than you thought?
Well, obviously not all of them, but I think it takes some of, it takes some getting used to this concept. But I think as we have more successes,
if you can sell books direct to consumer, you're essentially proving the ability of that book to be a successful in a bookstore. I would assume
that's right. And if we can say, look, you know, you have basically four people with not a lot of money, but just some sort of careful thinking about it and some focus, have managed to reach several thousand consumers.
So
you think you, with your magnificent sales force, can reach several,
and
many
thousand? And what you're getting back is essentially the notion that it's a zero-sum game. You sold 4,000 or 5,000. Mm-hmm. That's, we take that off of the number that we can sell. That means we'll be able to sell fewer, so I'm less interested in
it. You know, I don't think it's even gotten that far. No, I think people... innovation does not come quickly in book publishing. And I think people are still getting used to this idea.
Because it just seems to me it would be, like, it makes it easier for
a
publisher.
Well, yeah, in a way it's a combination of book packaging, and we've done a lot of the hard work.
You've set up the market, and you've proven the saleability of the book.
I think that's right. I think going forward, it's going to get easier. Because, you know, we've signed up some authors that really are top of the line, you know, people like, Bill McKibben's doing this, doing a global warming reader with us. We have Laura Flanders coming up, you know, she's this wonderful progressive commentator. And we have Doug Rushkoff doing a really cool book in a few weeks. Eileen Miles, Gordon Lish, we've spoken about. We have Norman Finkelstein on the Middle East. Just some people that you'd want on any list.
So have you had authors come to you yet?
Oh, sure.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And they, they've read about you or they've heard about it and they want to participate.
Right. Yeah.
So I think that's a good sign.
Almost every single agent, one or two, we just couldn't come to terms with. and it wasn't because of the advance. They just couldn't get their heads around what we were doing. But I think, I'll tell you something, I am certain, you know, maybe Or Books will not be the company in 5 or 10 years, but some variant of what we are doing is going to be a component of publishing going forward, where you have people selling directly to consumers and then licensing it to traditional publishers. It works. It's not a very complicated concept. And it can work for the traditional publishers too, as you said.
No, here the only question I have, I think, is sort of looking forward. Is there a kind of tipping point that could happen, as we might imagine? You know, people are worried about retail. You know, if for instance more bricks and mortar stores were to go away, at a certain point you have fewer places to sell those books. All right, when.
As we continue.
But so what happens then? In other words, into your model, in the part of your model which relies on publishers of printed books having access to a market that you don't want to be part of, they may not be there. That market may actually decline even further. It may be that print books will become more expensive as e-books take a larger share of the market and print runs decline. It may be that energy costs go up and therefore paper and freight become more expensive and therefore prices increase on the print side.
I think that makes sense to me. It would be difficult to look at the way things are going and not to agree that some version of that is going to, that we're certainly heading that way toward these more labor and material intensive processes are simply going to get more expensive. And while I hate the thought of neighborhood bookstores continuing to be faced with challenges, I certainly don't see an easy out for them.
No, although the neighborhood bookstore may find a way of reinventing itself as well. There are opportunities for them. Now, I don't know. I'm not in a position to say. I don't know whether, you know, it's likely that a neighborhood independent store or even a chain store becomes in some way, you know, an e-book vendor seems to me less likely. But the notion of community is still powerful. The notion that people will organize themselves around a locale seems to me human.
Yes. It's an interesting phenomenon that other people have made the observation that with the rise of our sort of electronic-based culture, that in fact, all of a sudden we've seen the renaissance of lectures and actual in-person events that it becomes, you know, it's almost something out of the 19th century.
Right, you see that.
For the 60s and 70s and 80s did not see this.
Right.
All of a sudden you have these halls that are filled with people going to educational lectures.
And then you have the rise of
conferences.
Local agriculture, craft beers, artisan cheeses, all these things which are coming forth because of the need that people have to have a human connection, and the increasing digitization makes us less connected. So although some of those digital tools actually do make us more connected and they enable us to communicate with each other in deep ways, still we want that face-to-face contact. And it may be, we don't really know. That, you know, future is not linear.
Right. I sure agree with that. But to hold myself to try and answer your question about, you know, which is a good one, about our future market drying up. Well, I would have no comment on that because I think that I'd make a very conspicuous no comment, but I would say to that exact point, but I would say we're obviously in a period of transition, right, for the next couple of years. And for the next, maybe a little longer, who knows, things happen so quickly. In the next few years, the stores and the print area still are dominant.
Absolutely.
But so while there's a slow decline in the sales of physical books. I mean, sure, it changes, you know, before somebody writes in and says, well, actually, in, you know, July, sales... Overall, the last few decades have seen a proportional, you know, decline in the number, you know, what your first print run is going to be, and a skyrocketing number of ebooks. You know, we still have, we haven't yet reached the point where those numbers cross. But, I mean, obviously, it's coming real soon. I think OR Books will be nicely positioned because we do sell electronic books. And
and because you have the relationship with the consumer.
Right.
Which I think is a very powerful driver.
And I also got to say, I'm not convinced that Amazon is going to be the last word in online retailing. I'm not so sure that that's, you know, they're facing huge challenges from Apple, and Google is coming up with Google editions. You know, I don't see why, in the same way that Amazon, to use an off word somebody introduced me to not too long ago, the same way Amazon disintermediated the stores, why the next step is for publishers to disintermediate Amazon.
It seems possible and very plausible. Listen, John, I want to thank you for talking to me. This has been David Wilk talking to John Oakes of OR Books for Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book business. Thanks.
Thank you.